From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. This morning we speak with psychologist, neuroscientist, and director of the Emotion and Self-Control Laboratory at the University of Michigan, Dr. Ethan Cross. He joins us to explore the world of managing our emotions so that they don't manage us. He'll discuss his new book, Shift. Then, Lynn Ware Peake speaks with Dr. Jake Viegel, a sports medicine physician at Intermountain Park City Hospital's Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness Center. Now that it's nearly March, how are you doing on those New Year's resolutions? He talks about weight management, what's new with GLP-1 drugs, and how to manage your metabolism. We'll be right back.
Welcome to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
Mainstream researchers have long considered feelings, moods, and other emotional processes a confounding black box that was impossible to measure and generally not worthy of quote-unquote serious study. But during the years since our next guest, Dr. Ethan Cross, began studying people's struggles with emotion, the field of psychology has undergone tectonic shifts. This now vibrant area of research that draws scientists from multiple disciplines results in a huge field of this study of emotion. Dr. Ethan Cross is a psychologist, neuroscientist, and the director of the Emotion and Self-Control Laboratory at the University of Michigan. He joins us today to discuss his new book on the topic, which is called Shift, Managing Your Emotions So They Don't Manage You. Dr. Cross, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thanks so much for having me, Lynn and Mary Beth. It's really great to be here.
Ethan, this is something that you have been interested in since you were a kid, really. And you start your book with this fascinating story about your grandparents who were victims of Hitler's brutal regime. But they lived, they survived. And you always wanted your grandmother to talk about it, and she wouldn't. And that's kind of how you kick off the story. Tell us how that affected you and made you think so much about sort of denying our emotions.
Well, my grandmother's story and my experience with her just raised so many questions, because on the one hand, my parents taught me, and I have long heard, that when you're experiencing difficult emotions, it's really important to dive into them, get to the bottom of the problem so you can move on. But my grandmother, who lived a beautiful life when she escaped the Nazis and made it to this country, she did not practice that approach. So the short version of my grandmother's story was she narrowly escaped being slaughtered by the Nazis. Her entire family was decimated, moved from ghetto to hiding places in the frozen woods for several years before she eventually came to this country with nothing, and then built a beautiful life. And I spent every day at her house after school when I was growing up. And all I wanted to know was, what happened during the war? How did you do this? Why didn't you do that? And every time I would ask her those questions, she would deflect and say, don't worry about it. Just enjoy your life. Except for one day a year when she and her fellow co-survivors organized a grassroots type of Remembrance Day. And they would spend half a day or so getting up to the pulpit in a local congregation and just lamenting what happened to them, going over in detail the experiences. And so here I had this individual who I worshiped in many ways. My grandmother loved her deeply. And I just found that to be such a curious way of managing emotions. And it really played a part in me getting really interested in this broader question of, what do we do when we experience curveballs from life? How do we manage those experiences so that we thrive in life? And went to graduate school to learn how to use the tools of science, psychology, and neuroscience to weigh in on those questions. And that's what I've been doing ever since.
Wow. As a neuroscientist, this question that you've really had your whole life since you were a kid is now able to take an actual scientific turn for you. What does repressing emotion, or maybe not experiencing emotion in the right way, actually do to our brains and our bodies?
Well, that's a complex question, and I'll try to give you a simple answer to it. Not one thing. because I think it's important to recognize that when we are, for example, trying to, let's say, avoid a problem, that's a dynamic process that's playing out over time. So if we were to break it down, let's say I'm trying to distract myself from thinking about something painful. And distraction is a nice, like, I like to use that as a healthy avoidance tactic, as long as it's not used chronically, like as your own rule. But so what's happening when you're distracted? Well, you've got an emotional experience. The first thing you have to do is divert your attention. And so you're harnessing areas of our, what we would call our cognitive control network. This is a constellation of brain regions that are located in the front part of the brain, like right behind your forehead, as well as above your ears and on the side. So it's like a network. It's one real development we've had in neuroscience over the past 15 years or so is that we've shifted from talking about there being like a specific brain region that is the seat of emotion or repression to understanding that the brain works much more like a network. There are lots of different parts of the brain that are almost like an orchestra working together to help you achieve certain kinds of goals. And so you're harnessing parts of your brain to divert your attention away from the problem, right? If attention is your mental spotlight, it's like where it shines. So we're going to shine that spotlight somewhere else. Then initially, we may need to keep our effort machine going to keep the spotlight on that other thing, because we may be assaulted by reminders of this problem that are cueing us to turn the spotlight back. So we might actively want to resist those. But if you succeed in really engaging with an immersive distraction, so for me, I will often like dive into something demanding at work that really captures my attention. That can often be sufficient for repelling that assault of reminders. And ideally that's what you do, but you know, you want to be sensitive too. If you're trying to avoid something by distracting so you can let the temperature on the problem die down a little bit, come back to it later in a way that's more productive. One big theme of the book and my life work is that there are no one size fits all solutions when it comes to managing our emotional life. It's not about approaching or avoiding. Sometimes it is.
Well, let's dive into some of those things. That sounds wonderful. I think all of us, we're becoming a lot more aware of how our feelings, our emotions are just a part of the terrain of our lives than I think our grandparents and pre-generations did. What are some of the other things besides avoidance, besides distraction?
Well, so there are two big categories of tools. I like to give people categories because it helps us remember where to find these tools. Some of the tools are things you could do on your own whenever you want. Other tools involve the world around us, other people, our physical environments, even the cultural institutions that we belong to. If we start with some of the things you could do on your own, perhaps the easiest low effort set of tools refers to a category of experiences that we have all had, but may not have thought about as emotion regulation devices, which are our senses. So Mary Beth and Lynn, do you like listening to music?
Sure.
Why do you do it?
It's absorbing.
Go further.
Well, I'm a musician in another part of my life. So I play music. It's just a massive part of my life. And it makes me think in all these different levels, like about it allows you to be in touch with emotions. I like sad songs when I'm sad. I like happy songs when I'm happy.
Let's jump into that. So
yeah.
When you ask people the question I just posed to you, close to 100% of people will say they listen to music because they like the way it makes them feel. Feeling being the conscious experience of an emotion.
Those people are more succinct than me. That's good.
No. You went where we needed you to go. It was great. If you then go and do studies as we've done and ask people, hey, the last time you were angry or anxious or sad, what'd you do to manage your feelings to feel better? Only between 10 and 30% of participants report using music as a tool to strategically shift their emotions. So when I come in touch with data like that, 100% of people are telling me they do this thing, listen to music, because they like the way it makes them feel. but then only 10 to 30% are actually availing themselves of that tool. I think that's a huge missed opportunity. So music is a kind of sensory experience. You could think of the senses like having satellite dishes mounted all over your to your all over your body. And the job of these satellite dishes, your senses, is to bring in information about the world around you. And one of the key reasons why we need all this information about the world around us is that so we can understand how to navigate that world. What's safe? What's dangerous? So we have sight, we have hearing, we have smell, we have touch. Really, this very powerful apparatus to make sense of the physical environment. One of the way the senses work is through emotions, right? Because you need to know, should you approach or avoid? Have you ever brushed up against someone who smells really, really bad? Has that elicited an automatic emotional reaction in
Oh,
you?
yes. Oh,
yeah,
yeah.
Right. I mean, like, you're human. Nothing to be ashamed of. There's no judgment here. This happens to all of us. I was flying back from overseas a couple of weeks ago, and I was going through all the shops in the international terminal, and I came across an emotion regulation emporium. Have you ever seen that?
Oh.
Yeah, it's called the duty free shops.
Oh.
You know why I've renamed it that? Because 75% of the merchandise consists of perfumes and colognes. What are
That's so
perfumes and
true.
colognes? These are regulatory sprays. We're spritzing these things all over ourselves to change the way we feel about ourselves when we, I smell nice, and to manage how other people feel about us when they come in contact with us. So the senses, these are powerful emotional shifters. The effects aren't necessarily always long-lasting, but they can be a powerful shift in a particular direction that can then open you up to do other things. Now, I want to go back to music for one second because, Mary Beth, you said something really interesting. You said you like to listen to sad music when you're sad, happy music when you're happy. Well, that's a very well-established phenomenon. It's called the emotional congruency effect. And what it means is we seek out experiences that match our mood state. Now, if your goal is to stay sad, then that makes a lot of sense to continue listening to sad music. And I haven't told you this yet. You've seen the book, so you know this about me, of course, but I'm a proponent of the belief that all emotions are useful in the right proportions, not too big, not too long, including the negative ones like sadness. Sadness is an emotion that we experience when we encounter some challenge to our worldview that we can't correct. You lose someone you love, you get fired, nothing you could do to change that. So this emotion of sadness, it motivates you to turn your attention inward, to make new meaning. If you need to stay in that state and it's productive, it's useful for you, by all means, keep listening to Chicago and Adele. But if your goal is to not feel sad, then just listening to that music is just going to perpetuate that undesirable state further. So I think learning about how all of the senses impact our emotions can be really helpful for allowing us to be much more strategic in how we utilize them in our lives. We talked about attention, right? You can focus on something or away. We often hear that focusing away is harmful. It's not true. Being flexible with whether you approach or avoid or do both can be very helpful. But the final thing you could do on your own that I'll flag and then I'll turn it back over to you is something that we call our perspective shifters. So if you think about your mind like a camera, you could focus the camera lens on the thing that's bugging you or away from you. What's so fascinating about the human mind is this camera that we possess, our minds, it also comes with a filter. So you could change the way you interpret what you are looking at. And your interpretations carry a ton of weight for how you feel. But I share this anecdote in the book that captures, I think, the frustration that a lot of people experience when they hear, well, just focus on the bright side. My wife and I were driving back with another couple from dinner in Detroit one night. And a friend of mine was bemoaning a significant problem he was experiencing at work. And after telling us the story, his wife says, well, why don't you just focus on the bright side? Just, you know, reframe it. Think about all the good that could happen. And he pauses, turns to her and goes, yeah, easier effing said than done.
Well, that brings up a good point about how we recognize when we have dwelled on something long enough in an emotional way. How do we identify when we're experiencing emotions in a healthy way and when we are either suppressing them or when we're just dwelling?
Well, great question. So there are two, first of all, this is going to differ for every person. And I don't think that should come as a surprise, because if you think about it, we all have very unique emotional lives, right? Our emotional lives have often been described as akin to a fingerprint, utterly unique. And so it also makes sense that we're going to have different trajectories of emotional responses and different ways to manage them. Now, the warning signs you want to focus on with respect to identifying when is an emotion being triggered out of proportion has to do with its intensity and its duration. So if we're talking about negative stuff, is the emotion being activated too intensely given the circumstances that we're in? And is it lasting too long? More difficult circumstances typically lend themselves to more intense and more long-lasting responses. And I think that's something that is really important for people to recognize. Like, big problems call for bigger emotions. That's your body responding appropriately.
I have a sign on my office wall, the poem by Rilke, the line, go to the limits of your longing. It says, let everything happen to you, beauty and terror. Just keep going. No feeling is final. Kind of talking about that intensity and duration.
Yeah.
I think so many poets, artists, people are, they tend to celebrate the ups and downs of emotions, perhaps more than the average person. But those are exactly the things that affect us and make us wonder about these things.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's, and I think it's also the case that our culture doesn't necessarily help us when it comes to this question of how to optimally manage our emotional lives, because the messaging that we often get from our culture is that the goal should be to live lives that are free from negative emotion, right? We want to maximize the positive, zero negative. A, if that's your goal, A, it's not possible, because we were designed to experience a broad suite of negative emotions, as anyone who is listening knows full well, right? B, those emotions, those negative emotions actually serve a function. They help us as long as they don't get too big and last too long. I think just knowing that, though, I think can be a powerful reframe for people. It takes the edge off when you find yourself being angry or anxious or sad, or you're experiencing some envy. It doesn't mean there's anything wrong with you. It means to the contrary, there's everything that is right with you. Yeah, it's true. We don't want let those emotions carry on too long, but we can learn from those emotions. Like, when I experience envy, that alerts me to a circumstance that, hey, maybe I can achieve this. And if this other person who's like me is outperforming me in this way, my God, that's amazing. That means I could do it too. And now all of a sudden it's motivating, right? Like, that's a total shift on this experience of envy, where I'm no longer feeling bad about myself as this insecure individual who's comparing himself to someone else and begrudging their accomplishments. No, this is a little system inside me that's saying, wow, someone else who's like you achieved something that you care about and you haven't achieved yet.
So that's a really great example of shift, you know, the name of your book.
Yeah.
But it still seems like managing emotions in a way, just by thinking, by shifting your thinking. And I wanted to ask, and so that, I really love that part, that concept. But I wanted to ask about when we don't know that we're suppressing emotions. And here's something that everyone can identify with. We all wore masks during COVID. I thought it was just fine. I got really used to it. I liked that I didn't have to put sunscreen on that part of my face because the mask covered it up. I loved that I didn't get sick. And yet now, when I am a little bit sick and maybe I'm going on a plane, I will get a mask, but I get this feeling inside me that I didn't know that it was kind of this traumatic thing altogether. For everyone, it was. I didn't identify it back then, but it sure gives me this visceral feeling now.
I think you want to not overcomplicate things when it comes to our emotional life. So if you find yourself in a circumstance where you are consciously, which is to say you become aware that some experience is affecting you in a way you don't want to be affected, that's a cue that, yeah, there may be some issues you want to attend to. So, you know, if all of a sudden the mere sight of a mask is causing anxiety, then, you know, that might be something we want to figure out. Well, why is that happening? And we can try to expose you to that issue in a way that neutralizes that reaction. But, you know, there are narratives out there about how, you know, we don't really ever forget these negative experiences and they can come back to haunt us and we need to address all of them. The data there are not compelling in the sense that there are lots of things that happen to us that we are incredibly resilient in response to. No need to go back and plunge the depths of our experiences to work over every single one of them and go to our, you know, toolbox of shifters. It's a big one to deal with it. I'll give you a personal example here. So my parents got divorced. I tell this in the book. My parents got divorced when I was 12 years old. It was a really unpleasant experience at the time. The school I went to, no kids' parents were divorced. It was shameful. It was painful, about as big as you can get in terms of the negative emotions that a 12-year-old could endure. I am totally at peace with what happened to my parents back then. I can talk about, like, I'm not experiencing really any negative affect, or that's what we call negative emotion in the lab. I'm not experiencing any of it right now as I recount that to you. I rarely, rarely think about that experience. And when I do, I think it was a good thing for my parents and for me. It was just not a match that was meant to be. My dad, on the other hand, still likes talking about it and still insists that we deal with the pain that occurred back then. And my response to him is, the only pain that is arising right now is your insistence on continuing to talk about this issue, which is clearly still affecting you. And you have my empathy, and we could talk about that if you want, but I'm okay. And so I bring this up because there is this very strong cultural belief that the way to deal with negative events is always to approach and work through them and dredge them up. And, you know, I'm talking about culture here for a very specific reason. The final shifter that I talk about in my book is culture. Culture is a tool that we can use to not only manage our own emotions more effectively, but it's a tool we can use to help other people manage their emotions. And I think we're often blind to it. And, you know, the two of you, with this platform, you're in a position to shape culture around these issues.
And so how can we use space or culture to help us shift?
So culture is like the air we breathe. It's all around us. And it has three components. Culture are our values and beliefs. What are the things we actually believe? What are the things we care about? In my family, which is a kind of culture, we believe it's important to manage your emotions rather than being managed by them. We value that. And we also believe that there are no one-size-fits-all solutions. So culture is also about practices, tools. So we talk about the different tools that exist for managing emotions. That's something that we care about in this culture. It's not boring, but we have conversations about it. That's how you begin to shift a culture.
Dr. Ethan Cross is our guest, and his new book is called Shift: Managing Your Emotions So They Don't Manage You. I picture families with your book and finding solutions among generations, which is kind of how this all came about. So, Ethan, thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life.
Well, thanks for having me.
Welcome to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. Well, the most popular New Year's resolution that people set has to do with, no surprise, losing weight. And studies show the majority of people will fail and even give up by about this point in the year. Only you know if you're one of those people, but my next guest has a pretty good insight into what happens often by the end of February and how we can all fix that. Dr. Jake Viegel is a sports medicine physician at Intermountain Park City Hospital in the Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness Center, which is part of sports medicine and performance. He believes sports medicine is the best specialty in all of medicine because it helps people become better versions of themselves and to achieve their goals. Dr. Jake Viegel, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you, Lynn. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's really great to have you. And it's so interesting that you're in sports medicine. So not only are you helping people fix their injuries, but you are helping them towards better performance. And part of that performance is achieving wellness overall. I mean, it's all coming together in maybe what were previously different silos into this overarching goal of wellness in general. Can you expand on that?
Yeah, so I do think that sports medicine does offer an excellent training platform for somebody who's interested in the lifestyle medicine and kind of wellness part of life. It's interesting, being healthy is such a vague concept. How do we really define who is healthy, who isn't? Fortunately, we do have labs that we can draw and we can do some other things to assess parameters, but in many times it is not really, oh, I am now healthy and I'm not. It's more of a continuum where it's like we're always trying to get as healthy as we can. I do actually really like the Intermountain Health motto of helping people live the healthiest lives possible. And I really have kind of embraced that as a way to help my patients.
Yeah, it's great. And at Intermountain Park City Hospital, I believe there is a greater potential for really achieving high wellness because many people who live in Summit and Wasatch counties are really tuned into health anyway. But that doesn't negate the fact that 95% of us think about a healthy weight. So let's go into that. Let's go into New Year's resolutions. It is kind of a shame, and it's so common that everyone makes this New Year's resolution and oftentimes abandons it. What's a new take that we ought to have on that New Year's resolution of losing weight?
Well, my goodness, I think that really is everybody's kind of goal. I want to lose 5 pounds, 15 pounds, 20 pounds. And I think what happens is we set these goals so high and we have these expectations that are so high that it makes it really difficult to maintain for very long. And it might be better to break them down into smaller bite-sized portions. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm all in favor of reaching for the stars and going for the best you can. I really think that's important. But if that's all we do, then it just really becomes hard to attain it. And then we kind of fizzle out. Breaking things down into smaller bits, instead of losing, say, I want to lose 20 pounds by June, you can say, I want to lose a pound a week. And then you're thinking, okay, I've got to get to this weight by Sunday when you weigh yourself. And it's, of course, it's not that accurate because our weights go up and down all the time, but it's a little bit easier to think about than, okay, I'm restricting everything. I'm exercising probably too much. I'm going to get myself hurt. And then it just kind of cascades into this thing where you start to just think, well, you know what? I just can't do this anymore.
It seems to me that if we took a different approach to losing weight than actually thinking of it as losing weight and more thinking of it as overall wellness. I don't know. It's a lot easier to like get your mind around it because losing weight seems about like scarcity and mm-hmm. You know, it's like a negative thing. It's not like a positive thing. Wellness is a positive thing.
Certainly. I think having that kind of mindset is huge. If you think about people who have kind of embraced the identity of wellness, you kind of transition that to somebody who has basically embraced the identity of they are a runner. And my wife is like this, so I can use this as an example. She definitely is a runner. She runs every day. And if she doesn't, she does something else because she's trying to cross train. And having that identity or that mindset of this is who I am as a person, I think is one of the keys to finding that success with weight loss. And it's not necessarily being I'm the guy who's losing weight. It's like I'm the guy who's living as healthy as I can. And when we do that, we find the weight actually naturally kind of drops, or even some people need to gain a little bit of weight, to be honest.
Really? That's interesting. Now, if you take someone like your wife, for example, who really enjoys exercise, not only for wellness, but just for lifestyle in general, like she identifies with what makes her feel really good about exercise. And you hear people say, I just don't like to exercise. And in my mind, it's like, what? You don't like to exercise? You mean you don't like to feel that those endorphins, or you don't like to feel that wellness and that great feeling you get at the end of exercise? It seems like such a natural thing, but it kind of maybe what you all do at Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness and in sports medicine in general is get people to reframe their thinking around wellness. How do you go about doing that? I mean, you're nuts and bolts. You're a doctor, not a psychologist.
Yes, 90% of medicine is probably psychology, yes. So first of all, if you don't like running, telling somebody to go run to lose weight or other exercises is not going to work, right? You have to kind of pick something that you enjoy. And if you really don't like any type of physical activity, I just don't think that person exists. I think everybody has something that they like. It might be something as simple as taking a walk with your friends in the morning, having you're not exercising, you're having a conversation and catching up on neighborhood gossip or whatever. And you're kind of, you're not really thinking about, oh, I'm going out here and I'm walking, and you're engaged in something social. And that is one way of doing it, especially if you have friends who are interested in that. Because if you don't show up that morning to walk, they're going to be roasting you and giving you a hard time. So it's a matter of finding what it is that works. Now, at our center, we have a lot of specialists who are exercise physiologists. They specialize in exercise. And it also helps that they're really fun, charismatic people. So when people go to the classes, it's like you connect with them and they kind of get you energized and help you figure out what you like. I initially, lifting weights, I thought it was a chore. And as I started doing it more often and started seeing some progress, it really is motivating to keep doing it. And there are days at the end of the day where I'm like, oh, I don't want to go to the gym tonight, but I go anyways and I feel good afterwards. And there's a difference between, yeah, I don't really want to go, and this kind of, you have to kind of figure out what you want to do and you just do it anyway, especially if you're tired, you just don't want to. And then you always get the benefits afterwards. But that takes more discipline than a lot. So a lot of it is teaching, like, behavior discipline. You just kind of have to do it. And that's when the mindset comes in. I do this because I'm a runner. I do this because I like to, because I'm a hiker.
If you envision yourself as what you feel like after the exercise or after the wellness, it's so much easier. Like you say, it's that mindset and the shift in thinking. Many people chalk it up to accountability. They get dogs, for example, to say that I have to be accountable to this dog who has to get out. It makes me go. And so again, it's that accountability, and it's creating kind of a community around that as well. You have all accomplished there at Park City Hospital, Intermountain Park City Hospital, within the sports and wellness and lifestyle medicine and wellness center, is creating that community. Let's talk a little bit about weight loss, since it is something that crosses the mind of most people from time to time. The GLP-1 drugs, it's all the talk and the rage. But overall, what are you seeing with them, and how big of a tool in your toolbox are they?
So this medicine works really well in taking down our hunger and cravings. The interesting thing about living in America is we have an abundance of cheap food. And this food is not really healthy. It doesn't fill us up. It doesn't make us feel satiated and have that satisfaction. So we just want more of it and more of it. And then we end up feeling like, okay, I'm done here. And then you're just over full and you've eaten too much. And it's kind of a sad state of how we've developed our food. I mean, it's kind of, we've sacrificed quantity over quality. I mean, in the manufacturing centers of the industry. With that being said, it makes it really difficult to lose weight on your own without medications, because our brains are programmed to crave this high calorie, highly flavorful, with mostly with artificial flavors and stuff that tricks our brain to think that we're actually eating something healthy when it really isn't. And so this is like the modern miracle to help the modern ill, in a way, this medication. And it really works well. You know, when we start to lose weight, we have evolved to think that we're starving and that if we don't get food, we're going to die. That's how serious it feels when you are dropping pounds, because it's like, if I don't get this, then, you know, if this keeps going, I'm going to starve to death and die. That's wired into our brain. Now, it's also why when we begin to gain weight again, when we stop our diet, we've all been there, right? And then the weight comes back. Our bodies are also thinking, well, I almost died once. I better put on even more pounds. And then we kind of get this new kind of set point, 10 pounds heavier than where it was when we started the diet. So what we do with the medicines is it just helps us kind of with those cravings. A lot of people say that the food noise goes away. And when you're losing weight, you just don't seem to care about getting another meal. Like normally when you're losing weight, sometimes it's all you can think about. The medicines do work well. They are approved for diabetes. They are approved by the FDA for weight loss as well. Unfortunately, most insurance companies do not cover them for weight loss alone. They will cover them mainly if you have other comorbidities like diabetes, and they are incredibly expensive. So I think cost is a big prohibitive factor for the medication, but they do work well. Side effects, you know, it's loss of appetite, nausea, constipation is a big one. And sometimes people just really feel sick, and they're usually on too high of a dose, so we can adjust the doses. The most important thing I tell my patients who are on these, and if I prescribe them, my rule is if you're on this medication, you must lift weights. You must have some resistance training going on, because they work so well that I have the concern that you're going to lose too much muscle. So lifting weights, resistance training is basically, it goes hand in hand with this medication. A lot of people like to do endurance sports and other types of activities, and they don't really want to lift weights, but that's what our exercise physiology team is for, to kind of help them do resistance training in a way that's fun and not the meathead kind of way that maybe people think of. So,
yeah, that's really interesting. What physiologically is going on that you would be losing muscle as you're losing weight? What do we lose first? It's a very simple question, but I guess I don't really know the answer.
Isn't it interesting? You think we would, you know, we've evolved to be, to seek after all these calories and things, but when we start to lose weight, our bodies actually will break down fat. I would say fat first, but it's also a little bit of muscle too, a little bit of protein. And even when we're losing weight, we still have the tendency to maybe lose a little bit of muscle. We do body composition testing on our patients, and it measures your body fat percentage, how much lean muscle mass you have. And it's very helpful in managing these patients, because if somebody is losing too much muscle based on their dieting, then we may have to adjust dosages or you know, make some adjustments there, or lecture them about lifting weights. And I say lift weights because it just flows out of my mouth, but really resistance training is a better term, and you can do that with therapy, with bands that fit in a drawer at home. You don't have to have a big expensive set, and you can use these elastic bands to lift weights. And if you do it until your muscles really can't do it anymore, and you're going to get a benefit from it. It doesn't matter if it takes 25 reps, but it can help, certainly help build strength, keep it there. And you also mentioned bone density and that impact of lifting weights can certainly be helpful for that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I'd like to go a little deeper into that. What is the physiological benefit of doing it to that exhaustion point, but more so than just doing a bunch of reps? It's the importance of getting to the exhaustion, right?
Yeah, you want that last one to be really hard, or even you just get halfway and you can't do it. This causes a little bit of fatigue in the muscle, and causes even a little bit of kind of breakdown. You could even call it damage. And then our body says, we're working hard here. We need to make ourselves stronger, so the next time we have to do this, it's not so difficult. And it's fascinating how our bodies think like that. But I think that's probably the simplest way of breaking that down without getting into the weeds of the science of it. But we're actually kind of breaking down our body a little bit so we can build it up stronger. And it's almost the same thing if we lose weight, but our body wants, we almost died. Let's make ourselves even heavier the next time if we have an abundance of food. But it's that similar thing. Let's get
Oh.
ourselves stronger for it. And I personally think that lifting weights or resistance training is the fountain of youth, especially as people get into their 70s and 80s. And
Wow.
it keeps you strong, it keeps you from falling, it keeps you out, keeps you fit in other ways. And so getting into a habit of it now is just going to be to your benefit. And you don't have to do it 5 days a week. You can do it twice a week or even once a week and get benefits from it.
That's good to know. Okay, let's take something really simple like push-ups, because push-ups can be resistance training, even though you're not using a band, right? You're using your body weight. What is the best way to do push-ups? Is it lots of reps? Is it doing it slow? And I'm asking you this because specifically because I just saw something on Instagram about a guy who was talking about how we mostly do push-ups incorrectly. And so, for this idea of resistance training, what should push-ups look like?
Well, yeah, that question is interesting because it really depends on what your goals are. If you want to be really, really good at push-ups, then you do a lot of push-ups. But if you want to
That's
get a
fine.
benefit of the exercise itself, then you can do this in different ways, where you can do, 20 push-ups and then rest and then do 20 push-ups again. Or you can just go until you can't go anymore. And you can call that your workout. And that might be, for some people, it might be 10 or 15 push-ups, and others it might be 60 to 80 or 100, but you do it until you can't do it and just do it one time, and you're gonna get a benefit from that. And you don't have to complicate it. It's one of the most simple exercises that we have. It requires no special fancy equipment. And if you want to say, okay, I'm gonna do my push-ups for the day, and you just do it until you that last one is just really difficult, you're gonna get a benefit from it. So
Yeah. And then also thinking of it as because I've been on this push-up kick, that's why I'm asking. But also, you're getting the benefit of tightening your glutes and doing plank at the same time that you're doing push-ups. So there are all these other, kind of functional things in there, which is great. So I wanted to go back to something we were talking about regarding the first place we lose fat. And I know that the most dangerous place to have fat is around your organs. I don't know, did they call that visceral fat, organ, fatty organs? If we're losing weight, it seems like that should be a benefit, the first benefit.
It's not fair that it's probably the last part we lose it. And you've seen somebody lose weight. We lose it and we gain it kind of in the same way, where the fat in our fingers, toes, face goes first, and then the last thing to go is that stubborn, we call it belly fat, but I almost think of belly fat as like, the paunch that us gentlemen get. And visceral fat is deep inside. It's the stuff that's around your intestines mainly. When we do our body composition testing, that is measured, and you can kind of get the sense for it of how much it is. And it's how do you get that to lose before the other parts? You can't. You just have to lose it, and it gets lower as we lose it. It is part of one of the last parts to go. It's very stubborn, and it's interesting to study because it's been associated with disease. So if you're working hard to combat your disease, whether that be high blood pressure or diabetes, obesity, that's going to be a part of it. It is. It's not fair. It's not fair. It's the last one to go.
Right. And so if we're still talking about visceral fat and fatty organs and all that, should we also be talking about nutrition? And this goes back, of course, to what you do at Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness Center, is it's the whole picture. Can we combat our fatty organs with diet in addition to weight loss?
Actually, diet is probably the best method to lose weight. To be, as much as I love exercise, it's my, you know, it's sports medicine is my training. It's what I love to do. Exercise is not the best way to lose weight. It is, in my opinion, the best way to prevent disease, and those are different things. because you can be overweight or obese and be completely healthy. You know, exercise to me is like number one disease prevention. Fountain of youth, disease prevention, exercise is the best medicine for that. Losing weight is 80% diet, and then the rest is genetics. And losing the weight, you know, with the diet is weight is really most of it. So we have great nutritionists, dietitians at our center who help people meal plan and discover what works for them as far as their diet. And if you're going to lose weight, that is most of it.
Yeah.
Exercise has been proven to help with weight maintenance. So people who lose weight, and maintain the weight loss, they do four things. They exercise 200 minutes a week. So that's 30 minutes on the weekdays and an hour on the weekend. They weigh themselves often. So if they get up a little bit, they kind of make some adjustments. Their diet is consistent, I guess. Almost limited is what some of the studies have shown. They kind of have their setup diet and they stick with it. And the fourth one is they don't have weekends where they kind of splurge on things. And I think that just becomes kind of a mindset. They have their system that works for them. And these kind of four things have been pretty successful for weight loss. So if you think about that, it's also going to be ways to help us lose weight. But yeah, but diet is it. If we're trying to lose weight, we got to adjust things in it with our diet. Now, that's often one of the reasons too why we give up in February, because food is so delicious and we've been programmed to seek after highly flavorful, high calorie, fat, salt, and carbs. And it's just how we're wired. It's how we're wired. So we're fighting this battle. Doing things and adjustments is sometimes helpful. As I said in the very beginning, you know, taking things into bite-sized portions. What that could look like is with a diet is like, okay, I'm going to switch my snack from, you know, Valentine's candy to celery or a carrot stick with I like celery with peanut butter, but very high in calories, but the proteins and stuff is also very satiating. So if you got this craving and you're just, oh, I just got to have something, you know, switching to something healthy is sometimes easier than sitting there in misery, just having this kind of, I can't eat anything because of such and such goal that I've set. And then after a while, you just can't do it anymore. It's like, okay, I'm done. And then you have, next thing you know, a half a bag of Doritos is empty. I'm not speaking from experience, of course.
Of course you're not. Yeah. And I shouldn't laugh because it's bad when we do that. It feels bad. And yeah, it reinforces that idea that we're not accomplishing what we set out to do on January 1st. Before I let you go, Dr. Vigil, I wanted to ask you the one question going back in the conversation to GLP-1 drugs like Ozempic. People who like to cast maybe a little bit of a negative light on these drugs, they all say the same things. You have to keep taking them or you gain the weight back because if you go off of it, your mind goes back to where it was before, the food noise comes back. What is your thought on that?
Yes, that's a good question. One of these medicines do work well, and people typically lose 15% of their body weight on these medications, and when they stop them, they gain about 5% of it back. So there is something to what they're saying is you do gain the weight back, but you typically don't gain all of it back. Now that's an average. Some people do gain all of it back, and some people don't gain any of it back, but it's an average of about 5%. And I said before, the things we try to teach people to keep it off is those kind of items of maintenance. Now, I do have a lot of people who, because this medicine works so well, they have a hard time coming off of it. I try to get people off of the medicine just because I think people don't want to have to be on medicines for a long time. And I get this question often for people who are on the medicine is, well, why should I stop? It's working so well. And cost isn't necessarily an issue and other things, and they're not having side effects. And I frankly don't have a great answer for that, with the exception, well, don't you want to be off medicines? Just because it seems like more natural. And it's like, yeah, but it keeps me going, and I use it. So really, I don't have a good medical reason to say to these people, yes, you need to come off. And it's almost like a moral judgment I think people are making. It's like you've done this with fake. You've done this in a fake way. Well, most of the food we eat in America is fake, and so this is a way to combat that. I don't really have a great argument for people who just say, why do you want me to stop? Because they're not sick. They're healthy. They're doing well. And until I come up with a good answer for that, then I'll have a better thing to say to those people. It's like, well, you're going to be on it for the rest of your life. It's like, well, that's good for the patient. Maybe we're giving too much to the drug companies. I don't know. We can dive into all kinds of little side things, but really, I don't have a good response to that question. Why should I come off?
Yeah, well, that is very interesting. And thank you for being so candid and frank about that question. Well, my guest has been Dr. Jake Viegel. He's a sports medicine physician at Intermountain Park City Hospital in the Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness Center, which is part of sports medicine and performance. There are a lot of words there, but it's essentially what we know is that there is something good out there at Park City Hospital for those of us who want to accomplish our wellness and fitness goals. Dr. Jake Viegel, thank you so much for joining me on The Mountain Life.
Thank you very much. Great to be on the show.
Thanks for listening to The Mountain Life here on KPCW. If you like what you hear, leave us a comment, rate us, and be sure to subscribe to stay on top of all of our show episodes. And if you have an idea for a future episode of The Mountain Life, email us at themountainlife@kpcw.org.